So good to be back here, and it's good to be back seeing my friends here. It's good for you guys on Facebook to be joining us. Welcome to Janelle, who's somebody new, and Karen, and Cheryl. I'm trying to think of all the new people. There's a couple new people within the groups of Fort Wayne and Kansas City. So welcome to all of you. We are now in 7 states. And I count Southern Illinois as a different state. Right? Right, Karen? So we have Minnesota, Southern Illinois, this Naperville area. We have Texas, we have Arizona, we have Kentucky, we have Indiana, and we have Kansas. So that's where we are right now. So welcome to all of you. Before we begin, though, I want to go through just a few things so that we know we're all on the same page. And then we'll get in right away to the lesson. And I will warn you, this lesson is going to go a little bit longer than it's going to go a little past 11 o'clock. 11 o'clock. Okay. It's definitely going to go past 11 o'clock.
Get a second cookbook already.
Yeah, right. First of all, your outlines will be on the Refreshing Eden page. So I'm not going to send emails this time. They'll be on the Refreshing Eden page. That's where you can download them if you need them. And they'll usually be on there by the night before. So what's really fun is I can actually schedule it now. So if I have it done early, I can schedule it. So most likely it'll be on by 5 o'clock or later. Depends on where I'm working. So it'll be on there. And it will be in the units section as well, right? So there's also a training video for, and that will be right at the very top of the page. It will be Caroline teaching us kind of how to navigate this Facebook group page. And very helpful, very short, so I would recommend watching it so you kind of can use at least the tools that we need there. At the end of this lesson, we are going to turn the lesson off, be done, and then we're going to turn on a lesson again, and that lesson will actually be the discussion group from the Naperville class. The Naperville class will discuss anything that came up during the discussion, during the lecture, that they want to talk about. It's either comments or questions they might have, and hopefully that will help you on Facebook to kind of join in. You can join in by typing questions, and we will try to answer those in real time if you're here during the live thing. But those also will be saved so you can watch the discussion as well. For perhaps some of your questions will be answered. Perhaps there's no questions, and perhaps it's just fun to be able to comment and perhaps share things that the Lord has done for us. We will put a link to the songs. So when I talk about songs, I will say that, remember, at the end of all the workbooks, I usually have at the end of each lesson some kind of an addendum. Last year we did a lot on video or on artwork. This time we're doing music. And here's the odd thing. I can't play music for you because of the copyrights. Oh. And I'm laying in bed last night thinking, why is there no such thing with art? I can show you all the art I want, but I can't play you the music, which is so odd. Anyways, for that reason, it's in your book. So what I have is, after the end of every lesson, I have two song selections for you to Google, listen to, but I have the lyrics in there for you, because then I can at least give those appropriate references. The first song will be a song mostly from the musical Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. And I'm doing that, number one, for something fun. It'll be fun to kind of go into there. But the real reason underneath is, so many times with music really pulls us in, right? It's an art. It's going to pull us in with our emotions, and it really pulls us in, and we begin to sing the song, and we sing it, and we sing it, and we sing it, and this happens all the time with all kinds of music. Most of the time, we never examine the words, right? And we never examine if these words are true. So what I want you to do with the Joseph songs is say, is this true? Is this what Scripture's teaching or not? Very interesting to watch where Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice wrote the lyrics, how they fit and how perhaps they don't fit. There are at least two lessons that are taken from the animated movie of Joseph, which is completely different than the play. And those were different songs. And those songs are more, even more interesting. So that's what you'll have in the first section. The second one will be a hymn. There will only be two hymns, one for the first section, the first four lessons of Genesis, and one for the last seven lessons of Genesis. So there we will put a link for the hymns. And hopefully for you on the watching it live stream, hopefully you'll play that before you listen to the lecture. That will just help you get into it. That's the theology that we really want to hold on to rather than the Joseph one. The Joseph's fun. You might want to dance with it. You might even want to watch it on YouTube. Really fun to be able to see that. Fun to see Donny Osmond. Donny and I are the same age, so it's kind of a fun thing to see that. But the hymn is what I really want us to go through with the rest of the week. So that's what I'd like you to do. So I think we can go ahead and begin into Genesis 2. So, have you ever watched a series, whether a TV series or maybe a movie that has several installments or even a book, but you didn't begin with the first season or the first movie? Things like Star Wars, right? Star Wars, I don't know how many movies Star Wars has. I'm not a Star Wars fan. How many?
Nine.
And that's just in the, like, 12. Just in the story, as opposed to the little one-offs.
Oh, okay. So there's at least nine movies in the Star Wars things. Now, I'm not a Star Wars fan, but it does seem that the last several holidays, except for this holiday, obviously, that is something our whole family does at Christmas time, is we go to the movie and we see the next installment of the Star Wars things. And I find that when I'm watching it, people are nodding and they're going, oh! And I'm sitting there like, obviously I'm missing something. Don't know what they're talking about. Because I really haven't followed it, right? I don't remember ever seeing the first movie. I probably did. I'm not a fan of science fiction stuff, so I certainly didn't see two or three. And nine, I had no idea. So I'm always missing something. I can enjoy the story to an extent, right? But I don't get it all. And everybody else in the theater is like, oh, and as soon as you walk out, right, everyone's talking about, oh, that was cool that they put in that character doing that, whatever it is. So the same thing is with our lessons in Joseph this time. So I've told you all we're going to focus on the story of Joseph. The problem is that we can't take Joseph's story as a standalone story. Just like the Star Wars, right? You can't take it. You can read it as a standalone story, and you can get a lot out of it, but you will miss so much of it. Joseph came from somewhere. Joseph, just like us, we will know Joseph more the more we know about his family, right? When I meet each of yours family, all of a sudden, I know a lot more about you, right? The first time I met Lisa's son, Will, it was like, oh, wow, there's little Lisa. Oh, this is this joyful guy that just, and it, all of a sudden it gave me a bigger picture, right? Of, oh, that's who Lisa is, meeting her husband. Oh, now I know even more. So when we want to look at Joseph, we also need to look at his family. And of course, his family is written about in Genesis. So we will need to take a look at Genesis 12 through 36. So it's not going to cover just 37 through 50, which is Joseph's story, but it will cover Joseph's father, Joseph's grandfather, and Joseph's great-grandfather, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We need to look at that. So the patriarchs are going to be our first four lessons. Now there's a little bit of a problem with that, because that means that we're going to go from chapter 12 all the way to chapter 36. 24 chapters in four lessons. Yes, you're going to read a lot, which is why I suggested read that before you come. Be familiar with it so that when you have to do your lessons, you're not overwhelmed. So the first four lessons do cover a lot of ground. I didn't want to focus on that, but it is so important. And in a perfect world, I would have gone back and said, oh, now we're first going to do Abraham, and then we're going to do Isaac, and then we're going to do Jacob. We're not going to do that. We're going to do the whole patriarch and Joseph and his brothers. So know that it's going to be longer readings. I tried to keep the answering of the questions the same amount, but your readings will be a bit longer. So you'll be a little more quickly going through and just asking certain questions, answering certain questions. The important lessons with about the patriarchs are there. It's really important. It's not just important for Joseph's story. It's important for us as well, because without understanding what God is doing in Joseph's family, Israel, we'll miss the fullness of what God is doing in his family today, the church. Right. So Israel plus the church is God's family. Without understanding what God is doing with his family, Israel, we won't fully understand what God is doing with his family, the church, today. And I actually think and believe that that is part of what's going on today, is we, the church, don't know what God is doing with the church. For some skewed reason, we think God is doing something with the world. But if we remember our Genesis 1 through 11, and we look at our Genesis 12 through 50, we're going to find out, no, God is still dealing with the church, his family. So we need to know that, and we'll talk a lot more about that throughout the lesson and even today. So we're going to connect the patriarchs with Joseph. But of course, Genesis doesn't start in Genesis 12. It started with Genesis 1, which we did last semester. Generally in the church, we separate all these stories, right? We talk about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We talk about Joseph. We also talk about creation. We talk about the flood. We talk about Babel. But how many times do we connect all of those? Because the creation and the flood and Babel all have something to do with Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. They're all connected. It's still one story. The truth is that Genesis 1 through 11 tells us why there had to be a family, a covenant family, why there had to be an Abraham, an Isaac, and a Jacob. So we're, of course, going to need to review quickly Genesis 1 through 11. So that's where we're going to begin this morning. I'm going to take a soaring view through Genesis 1 through 11. I'll stop in a few places because I think it's important. And before we get into the overview of where we're going. So we're going to look at where we've been before we look at where we're going to go. So, hold on. You've been here before, most of you. If you're new, it would be a good idea to go ahead and watch some of those videos. Genesis 0 and Genesis 1 would probably be the very best. Lesson 1, Lesson 0 and Lesson 1 would be the best. So, that's kind of what we're going to do. So, we need to look at the importance of paying attention, first of all. We noticed that our last semester, Genesis 1, was called Paying Attention to God's Presence. This semester, our focus is on paying attention to God's work. So, it seems like we need to review then what it means to pay attention, what that looks like, just in case we've forgotten how important it is to pay attention. So paying attention is important because it helps us to live in reality. It helps us to live in accord with reality. We know that if we're paying attention, we're going to flourish. And if we don't pay attention, we're going to disintegrate. Very simple little examples. If I'm not paying attention to where I'm walking, I'm going to end up walking into something, perhaps a tree, perhaps a light pole. And that will not help me to flourish. Just obvious, right? But if I am paying attention, if I'm paying attention to the speed limit when I'm driving, that's going to help me flourish because it's going to get me home safely. It's also going to make sure that no authority has to intervene. And so, paying attention is really important. Paying attention to reality and not paying attention to false reality, which means something that isn't real, that you've made up, that you have taken out of, right? If I pay attention to someone's needs, my relationships flourish. If I don't pay attention to someone's needs, particularly someone that I live with or see it every day, my relationships are not going to flourish. And so paying attention is very important for us to be able to flourish in reality. Why then do we pay attention? In other words, What is it that makes us pay attention? And I've done that a million times, right, in this study. And it always does the same thing, right? It gets your attention. Why?
It startles.
It actually prods your emotions. It might have been a different emotion from each of you. Some of your emotions might have been fear. Oh, that's the startle, right? A fear. Some of your emotions might have been anger. Why did you do that? Some of your emotions might have even been shame. A remembering of, oh, I'm not paying attention. Someone's telling me I should be paying attention. All of that is our attention is captured when someone prods our emotions. That's how attention and emotions are connected. So all emotions move us. And every one of you moved when I did that, right? Every one of you. Even if you knew it was coming, you moved. That's what emotions do. They are intended to move us toward one another, toward relationship. If there's nothing else you learned from last year, I hope you remember that. Emotions move us toward relationship, and they're always supposed to move us toward relationship. Fear is supposed to, even fear, even the ones we call negative are supposed to move us toward relationship. Fear is meant to move us towards someone who will comfort us. Anxiety is meant to move us towards someone who will soothe us. Anger is meant to move us toward an obstacle getting it out of the way of relationship. All emotions are meant to move us toward relationship. But in disorder, they can actually move us away from relationship. Thinking, our physical beings, our social relations, none of those motivate us to move. We might think they do, but that's not how our brain works. It is only emotions, because emotions are the first thing that actually happens to you when you encounter something in the world. Thinking, our body, our social relations are all slower actions. They work in the slower parts of the brain. Emotions is the one thing that work in the fast part of the brain. So we call emotions fast thinking, and we call analytical thinking slow thinking. If you move towards something to pay attention to it, some emotion has been prodded. Failure to move towards something that has captured your attention means that there is an attachment to something or someone else that is stronger than that draw. So if I would have thrown that book and two of you were talking in the back about something very important, you may have moved a little, but you might have continued talking because that attachment was more important than this emotion. Get that? Mm-hmm. It's what happens to us often when we pass someone in need and don't help, because our attachment is probably towards protecting ourselves rather than someone else. Or someone else, perhaps you encounter someone, they look kind of rough, you're in a neighborhood you don't know, and they call out to you. Your emotion says move toward that person, but you have other attachments in your life. And some attachments may be, I need to protect myself. Some, and that attachment might be right. Some attachments might be, my daughter's here, I need to protect her. So you have lots of things prodding your emotions, and whatever the stronger attachment is what's going to pull you either away from somebody or towards somebody. Make sense? Everybody with me? Okay. And that really makes a difference, right? We didn't talk a lot about that last time, but this time we're going to talk about that because it's going to happen in all of the characters that we study. So when emotions are prodded, and I move toward you, and I continue to pay attention towards you, I do so because in moving toward you, I perceive that you're going to meet my most basic need. And what is our most basic need?
Belonging.
Belonging. Belonging is our most basic need. And so when I continue to pay attention, and I continue to move toward you, I do so because my brain says, you're going to make me feel like I belong. because our need of belonging seems met, attachments then will direct our lives over and above anything else, any other component of our whole being. Emotions will begin to direct our lives. Remember, emotion is the strongest force in the human brain. It way overwhelms our will, which I always laugh at because we, especially as Americans, believe our will is our strongest piece, of our strongest component. What I decide, I will do. But it's not how the brain works. It is emotion that causes attachment that actually is the strongest force in our brain. So now you begin, especially as a parent, you begin to think, oh, I do need to be sure of who my children are attached to, right? But then you think about yourself. Who or what am I attached to? That needs to be something really thought through. So we have then attachments towards someone who has provoked our emotion so that we feel like we belong there, that they are making us belong. And attachments always begin by grace. And grace is being given a gift from someone. And the gift is twofold. It's either the other person calling us, prodding our emotion, is making sure that you know that they are so happy to see you, that they're so happy that you're here. Think about the last time you felt so welcomed. Did it not make you feel like you belonged? You walk into it and somebody's like, oh, you're here, right? Your being, your brain says, oh, I belong. That makes me feel. It began with a grace, a gift. But the other gift is being the recipient of someone's effort for your benefit. Not for a transaction, but somebody just wants to give you something, some kind of work. They washed your car for you, or they went out. I remember a semester ago, remember, everyone knows that I love Pink Lady apples. That's what I eat every morning. One day, the doorbell rings out of nowhere, and Anna is at the door, and she has a whole bag of Pink Lady apples. They were on sale, she says. And it's like, oh, that makes me feel so connected, right? That she thought about that, and she actually did some effort for me. Not so that I would buy her whatever she loves, right? She just wanted to give that to me. That is another grace that helps attachment, right? It helps you to feel like you're attached and that you belong. The truth is that belonging, that feeling of belonging, is often first experienced in the body through food, through feeding. That's often how we experience belonging. If someone makes us a meal, that helps us to really pull toward them, attach to them. And it might be that you're eating together. That's nice. But if someone makes you a meal, invites you and makes you a meal, they kind of combine those two of, I'm glad to see you, and I had made an effort for you to give you that. That creates a huge bond between the two people. So it's not surprising that our parents or our caregivers are our first attachment, because they're the ones who feed us, right? So because that... And it is also why we often confuse our most basic need. If I ask just a person on the street, what's our most basic need as a human being, what would they say?
Food.
That's why they say food, because it's their first experience of belonging. But it's not food. It's actually the sense of belonging. So we have emotions prodded that move us towards someone. We continue to pay attention, and there is an attachment formed. We feel we belong. And when there's attachment formed, attachment creates character. It actually molds character in you. Again, it isn't our will that changes or forms our character. It is, we don't decide to be kind. Although we've all tried it, right? Mm-hmm. We go to Galatians 5 and we say, oh, the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace. Okay, this week I am going to be loving. And I'm sure every one of you has tried something like that, right? And what happens? You fail immediately. Because it isn't your will that changes your character. It is your attachments that change your character. And so we are asked then to draw near to God so that he changes our character into his character. God is going to transform us. So we have our emotions prodded, forming attachments because we feel like we belong. Attachments change and form our character. And in the multiple times that we connect with those who that we're attached to, and we'll want to because it makes us feel like we belong over and over, we will have an opportunity to develop a mutual mind. And that is where we think alike. We think the same thoughts without having to use words. And you all know this, either a friendship or a spouse, you've all looked at each other without saying a word, knowing exactly what you're thinking about a situation. You have a mutual mind. And that only comes from attachment that is continually having paid attention to. I'm hoping that I keep watching the, it keeps on trying to reconnect. Can you kind of look in that and see what's going on? So, our changing character then changes our brain to think differently, to think like the person we're attached to. And when we begin to think differently, when our character is being formed, we then behave differently. I've lost page four. Yes. Oh, there we go. Just out of line here. So then what we pay attention to is pretty important, right? Because what we pay attention to is going to form our attachments, which is going to form our character, which is going to determine our behavior. So we can only pay attention to what we know about. Until technologies were available for us, we didn't know what was happening on the other side of the world. And so we couldn't pay attention to their needs and the fact that we had plenty to help them with. We couldn't pay attention to it. But once we had technologies that we would learn about, oh, the people in Haiti have had hurricanes and now they have a need and we have the supplies, we can help. Whatever that is, we can only pay attention to what we know about, which also tells you that if we want to be paying attention, we better be acquiring understanding and knowledge about things, right, that we want to pay attention to. But we also need to know that we only flourish when we pay attention to things that are in line with reality. Paying attention to a false reality will diminish our humanity. It will disintegrate our wholeness. Lots and lots of studies are done on this, right? When we have kids sitting in front of games for days on end, we find there, and this is what they found, even with the use of cell phones and being on the cell phone all the time in games, they're paying so much attention to a false reality, and they've done many studies, and it's sad, the studies are sad. What they found is that the first thing children lose, actually adults as well, is empathy. And the funny thing is, they didn't set out to look at technology and see how it affects. This is what happened. Many schools were finding that their children had no empathy for one another. A kid would get hurt on the playground and no one would care. And they couldn't figure it out. So they were going to the scientists, what's going on with our kids? And this was all over the nation. And that came after many years of study. Oh, it's because they're paying attention to a false reality. Mm-hmm. It's disintegrating their humanity. Mm-hmm. It's disintegrating our humanity. And so it's really, we need to understand that we need to pay attention to what is real. Anything not under the submission of God's order is a false reality. It says that something other than God can make you whole. So that politics that are not submitted to God's order says that power can make all things great. Economics that is not submitted to God's order says prosperity can make all things good. Drugs not submitted under God's order says avoiding circumstances makes all things good. And on and on and on. Any of those things not submitted to God's order will be a false reality and will disintegrate our wholeness. So, now we finally get into Genesis 1 through 11. That is kind of the intro that we had last semester on attachment theory, so we understand what's going on in Genesis. So God's story in Genesis 1 through 11 is the revelation of his presence. So this is where we've been. Big picture here. Big picture of Genesis context. We know that Genesis is theological history, which means that it is the beginning of God's story within the history of humanity. It reveals who God is and what he does because of who he is. But when we use the word history, don't think of it how we use history today. It's history in narrative form. And actually, we all like history in narrative form. What's everybody's favorite play in the last couple years? That's what it is, right? History in narrative form. That's what the Bible is. History in narrative form. It is God's history in narrative form. Well, why story? Why does God give us story? Because story is an art form. And all art forms
prod our emotions.
All art forms. Yes. Yes. I mean, that is a beautiful thing, right? That he would give us, he would tell us about himself in story so that it prods our emotions. He intentionally uses literature to prod our emotions. The Bible is literature. The Bible is not an informational manual or document. While the ordering of it into verses and chapters makes it feel like it is a manual, we have to remember that that wasn't original. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's very recent. It is in modern history that we did that. So,
why didn't we do it?
Because it just makes it easier for us. Somewhere I have. Walter Wangren wrote the Bible, Genesis to the Old Testament, God's story. It's called God's story. And it's just in story form. That's how it was originally written. So we have to remember that. It was in story form. Much of our misinterpretations from Scripture come from us treating it as a document rather than literature. Because when we treat it as a document, we ignore the nuances of genre, right? There's all different genres, right? We ignore poetry, we ignore theological history, we ignore apocalypse. We ignore cultural contexts, because if it's a document, right, it supersedes that. And we ignore literary techniques. And in fact, when we have our paradigm shifted, it's because we've been reading it as a document rather than as a literary piece. So we need to remember that it is written as literature and written as literature for a purpose so that it prods our emotions. Emotions move humanity, and God's desire in telling his story that way is so that he moves humanity toward himself in secure attachment and so that he molds our character for us and so that our character then displays behavior that actually reflects who he is. So we also need to know that the story has a setting. All stories have a setting, right? And maybe some of you love stories of old, maybe in the in the early 1800s, you love those kind of stories, or maybe you love stories, even farther back from that. And then there's some of you who really don't like it, those stories, and you just want to stay in modern times. But the truth is, no matter what story you watch, you've got to enter it into their context, right? You cannot take what's going on in that context and bring it to this context right away and evaluate it that way. God chose the ancient Near Eastern context and culture to tell his story. Now, do you think God knew that the cultures would change over time? Mm-hmm. Of course he did. But he purposely chose the ancient Near Eastern culture to tell his story. There was a reason why he did it. We don't know all the reasons, but we can pretty much figure out most of the reasons why. But that's the context he chose. So it's got to be read within that context. It's got to be read within the way they thought and not the way we think. How they thought about life, this is just a review, is that everything was connected to the deities. Their stories will always reveal the character of their deities, how they relate to humanity. Their starting point in the ancient Near East is always outside of themselves. And that right there should give you a hint. Why did God choose the A&E rather than American modern history? Mm-hmm. Maybe because they start from the point outside themselves. They also understood that existence meant that something had been assigned a function within an ordered system. What do we call that?
Functional ontology.
Yeah. Very good. So that is what they thought of existence. You exist only when you were assigned a function within an ordered system. We don't think that way. We think about form first. We think about our form determining who we are rather than someone, something outside of us. But they think, no, outside, somebody outside is assigning you a role, and that's how you exist. What do they care about? They cared about the questions, who and why. Who are the gods? Who are we? And who are we together? And why? Why are we here? What's the purpose of life? That's not what modern man thinks about. Our questions are how and when. How did something happen and when did it happen? Because we don't care about the purpose of life, which is what why and who is about. What's the purpose of life? Why are we here? That's what they care about. They're concerned about connections and purposes. We're concerned about, oh, what was it like then? How can we change it for the better for us now? How do we determine what we want? How do we change it rather than outside, which is how A&E's thought. So their questions always look to the future. How do I make my life fit the goal of life so I arrive where I'm supposed to? So that should color how we look at Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. We need to receive the story as written. It means that we need to put aside our own cultural context, including the way we write and the way we read literature, and the way we view existence. Put that aside and enter into the A&E context. It also means that we need to learn the biblical cultural context. That is actually very important. And then, and only then, can we bridge the contexts for application. And we do all of that so that we don't take what is description and make it prescription, which is what we do all the time, right? Oh, this is what we have to do because this is what Abraham did. No, this is description. We also don't want to make sure, we want to make sure we don't take literary techniques and make them literal commands. Got to be careful about that. We also don't want to dismiss God's order and actually make it according to our cultural order. So we've got to be careful about that. And it's easier to be careful about that when we know we're reading literature in a certain context. In other words, reading God's word is a serious business. It's important. It's not to be taken as a light endeavor, and it's certainly not to be subject to thoughtless interpretations. Now, I don't mean that as a dismissal of you wondering what God is saying. What I mean to say is you don't need to be fully educated in theology to study God's word. But you do need to be serious. You can't just take it lightly. Because taking it lightly will give you a false reality, and then you'll begin to live in a false reality, and then you'll be adamant that this is how it is. So you need to be serious about studying the word and about what the word is, that it is God's story. particularly as we go into the study of these four men, they aren't our examples. We're supposed to be looking at what God's doing, what God's working. And I want to reiterate that over and over again so that we're not looking at the men so much as, oh, what is God doing here? So that we can then bring it into our life. What's God doing in my life here? Not, I want to be like Jacob or I want to be like Joseph. It's, I want to be open to what God's doing in my life. So Genesis in the whole is put in three different parts. Genesis 1 through 11 is primeval history. We've already gone through this. The time frame is a distant past. It's covering a very long period of time. The focus is a world focus. How God relates to the world. God blesses humanity. And if we remember the word blesses, it means to kneel, to give yourself to someone. Always think about the kneeling for a proposal. I'm giving you my life. That's what God says when he blesses humanity. I'm giving you my life. And in Genesis 1 through 11, he's giving the whole world his life, which is why it's written the way it's written. Genesis 1 through 11 is written with hyperbole or in apocalyptic style. We don't often talk about that. We talk about Revelation being apocalyptic, but Genesis 1 through 11 is also apocalyptic. And it is that way, is written that way, because it is talking about the big world. It uses big words for a small event to say this small event represents the whole world. That's why it's written with hyperbole or apocalyptically. The world's response, from what we understand in Genesis 1 through 11, is that they refused to pay attention to God's revelation of himself to the world. And that tells us that we need a people who is actually paying attention to God. We need a people that's in relationship with God, which is what covenant is all about. So we need a covenant people. That tells us, oh, Genesis 12, this is why we need the family of Abraham. So, patriarchal history is Genesis 12 through 36. That'll be our first four lessons. The time frame is relatively recent past. Remember, Genesis most likely was written as Israel was being exited out of Egypt and going into the Promised Land. So they're looking back and saying, oh, the patriarchal history, that's recent past, relatively recent past, certainly much closer to us than creation. And so it's written a little more historically. The narrative slows down from Genesis 1 through 11. Just think about Genesis 1 through 11. In 11 chapters, we went from the creation of everything to the flood to past the flood. That's thousands of years, if not more. The focus in the patriarchal history is family. So it was world history in Genesis 1 through 11. Now it's family. They're going to focus on family, how God relates to his family. God blesses, gives himself to the family of Abraham. And it's written, instead of apocalyptically, it's written thematically rather than chronologically. So you're going to have to be careful with this because we particularly, when we're reading somebody's story, we almost always think it's chronological. And there will be times where you go, wait, how is that possible? It's not written chronologically. It's written thematically because it's going to deal with the specific issues of the family. We'll talk more about that as we get into it. What's the family's response in Genesis 12 through 36 for God's revelation of himself? They are gradually molded as they pay attention to his presence and work. And so it establishes a covenant people, a relational number of people who are actually connected to God. And then our last section of Genesis, which is what we call Joseph's story, Genesis 37 through 50, the time frame is immediately recent past as far as Israel's exodus is concerned. The narrative slows way down, covering a very short period of time. The focus is an individual focus. It focuses on Joseph and his brothers, individual brothers. God blesses Joseph, and this is written chronologically to address the advancement of the relationship and what the relationship is supposed to do. The individual's response is that the individuals are strengthened by his presence and work. And so a covenant people is incubated to be able to bless the world. So that's kind of the big picture of Genesis. So let's remember what we learned in Genesis 1 and 2, because we need to keep this in mind. And when you go to your workbooks, please read the introduction and the overview so that you know every week you're going to be doing the same thing. What's God's character that we learned in Genesis 1? What's God's character that we learned in Genesis 2? You're going to write it over and over again. You're going to get tired of writing it. And you're going to say, why did she ask this every single semester? Because it's important. And I want us to know. And so, in the beginning, Genesis 1, we see that God reveals himself to the world as wisdom. And he does so by ordering. First, he orders space. He orders space by his power, by the Spirit, hovering. Do you remember? Mm-hmm. The Spirit hovers. And what does the Spirit do when he hovers?
Devours.
What does he devour?
Chaos.
So we have the Spirit of God, his power, devouring chaos. Why?
To make space.
Exactly, to make space, right? If he's going to order, he's got to make space. He's not going to order within disorder. He's going to take out the disorder and make space for him to put in order. And so what it revealed to us is that God pays attention to what is needed to flourish. He is revealed as wisdom by ordering then three functions. And this is creation, right? This is reading creation functionally rather than materially. Three functions. They establish rhythms. The functions are what fill that space and will draw humanity to himself by creating a need for waiting for God to give them something. Waiting to receive. That's what the functions are there for. Who can name the three functions?
Time.
Weather.
Agriculture.
Those are the three functions that are created in the 6 days. Time reveals his faithfulness. You can't experience anybody's faithfulness without time. It's a relational rhythm of engagement and restoration. I work, and then I wait for him to restore me. Psalm says that he gives to us in our sleep. He restores us in our sleep. We wait for him to restore. We don't do the restoring. He does, right? That's that give and take. I'm going to work, and then he's going to restore. And I wait for him to restore. Weather does the same thing. It reveals his sovereignty, but it's a relational rhythm of being waiting to plant until he sends the rains that soften the grounds, which is why scripture often talks about the spring rains and the fall rains. Two different kinds of rains. One softens the ground. And Israel waited for God to send that, and then they could go to work. Then they could plant. They couldn't plant until the rains had come to soften the ground. And so, and Leviticus tells us, when I shall give you rains in their season, the land will yield its produce, and the trees of the field will bear their fruit. And the third function is agriculture. Agriculture reveals that God is the source of life, and the one who sustains life. It's a relational rhythm of harvesting with communal celebration. They waited for the crops to mature, to ripen, before they all together came and harvested everyone's crops together and then brought them in one place and celebrated together, which is what Jeremiah tells us. When he brings the autumn rain and the spring rain, he keeps for us the appointed weeks of harvest. What Genesis 1 tells us is that God is wisdom. There is no life apart from God. This is reality. So when we talk about wisdom, we don't mean somebody that's smart. What we mean from a biblical standpoint is that this is reality, and God is reality. There is no life apart from him. When we pay attention then to the natural rhythms that he has blessed us with, it keeps us in line with reality. And we could do probably 3 lessons on that. That's Genesis 1. Genesis 2 revealed to us reveals to the world that God is self-giving, because he gives what belongs only to him. And he gives us three blessings. Okay, can you remember the three blessings? The authority to rule, the power to create secure community, and presence, right? To be able to mentor and flourish. So, his authority to rule. It's the relational gift that enables man and woman to keep and tend sacred space together. We keep its integrity, where God is not presented with obstacles, and we keep its access open so all people can come to him. Second blessing is his power to create secure community he gives to us. This is the relational gift that enables a man and a woman to come together as helpers with God. And in doing so, joyfully they bear fruit. And that fruit, children, are there for them to model what secure community is so they can go out and do the same. So especially when we talk about this blessing, don't narrow it down to having children. It's actually the ability, the power to create secure community. And secure community is always three, right? It's always a community of three, a giving and taking. So it's a man and a woman and God, and that overflows to create children. So that's the second blessing. And the third blessing is his presence to mentor and fellowship. This is the relational gift that assures a space and time where humanity can be mentored and enjoy fellowship on a regular basis. This is the Sabbath of Genesis 2. And he does this so that they might have guidance on how to use their power to create secure community and their authority to rule. It's kind of scary to think you have the authority to rule and the power to create secure community and then just go off and do it, right? That's scary. Well, it doesn't have to be, because he's given us this very regular time to meet with him. And it ensures that the bearing of his image in the world is an accurate reflection. So the three blessings tell us that God is self-giving. Who he is, his character, is other-focused. And it is how the world continues. So when we pay attention to his blessings, as they're given, it keeps us participating in life. Genesis 1 and 2. Genesis 3, then, what happens? The world rejects God's revelation and subsequent attachment. The rejection of space-making. In the place of meeting God in Sabbath, and that Sabbath space, Adam and Eve rejected that. How did they do that? Well, remember, God says, "Where are you?" Because it's meeting time. They remain distracted by something else, right? By the serpent. And they give it full attention, forgetting that God is present and waiting for them to turn to him together. They say, "Well, we heard the sound of you." Remember, it's the same word as the spirit hovering. "Oh, we heard the spirit hovering. We didn't really want that kind of mentoring," right? We think mentoring should be happy, happy stuff. But sometimes it's, you know what, that wasn't the right way to do it. They rejected that. When they could have received wisdom about why eating from the tree at this time wasn't a good idea. They could have received wisdom about, "I'm going to feed you wisdom when it's right for you. So hang on and wait. Stay in that space." But they rejected that space. They also rejected the functional rhythms, because always the functional rhythms are about times of waiting to receive from God, to receive what God gives rather than taking, which is the key word when we get to Genesis 3, right? And Eve took the fruit, and Adam took the fruit from Eve. They refused the rhythm of waiting for God to give them that when it was time. The rejection of blessings They rejected the blessing of authority to rule. How did they reject that? What did they not rule?
They didn't keep the chaos.
The serpent, right? Remember, God was giving them that opportunity. Okay, here's some practice, guys. Here's something that's disordered. What are you going to do with it? Oh, we're going to pay attention to it. Oh, no. They were to rule it, and they gave that up, and they let the serpent rule instead. And what that does is it makes them hide from God's presence, but it also makes them hide from each other's presence so that it affects the individual. We have then, and we're zipping through, Cain, right? Cain continues to reject his authority to rule. He's supposed to rule and come in worship in the right ways. This is how it's supposed to be done. Remember, part of ruling is keeping the garden intact and open to others. He doesn't want it open to his brother. He wants it open to him. And so he rejects the authority to rule, and he defies God's presence. And in defying God's presence, he defies his brother's presence. And so it affects family relationships. And in each of these, as we go, remember Genesis 1 through 11 shows us God revealing himself to humanity and then humanity rejecting it and moving farther and farther away. And how do we know they move farther and farther away? What does it say? That's the very end. How do they move? What direction?
Away from Eden, east.
East. They always move east. Every time it says they moved east, and they moved east, all the way to Babel, and they moved east. It means they're moving farther and farther away from the center of order. After Cain, we have Lamech. And Lamech rejects secure community.
Because
he kills someone, but what is he? How does he first reject secure community?
The one that... the multiple wives?
He's got two wives, right? That's definitely not secure community. That's not the three he's talking about. Right? Secure community. Think about it. Any one of you, how secure would you feel if there was another wife?
Did she cook?
Kind of with you there.
If she
So Lamech rejects secure community, and in so, he ignores God's presence. He knows God's there. He just ignores it. But it also means he ignores his wives, and he ignores society. And it affects community. It affects society. Remember, Lamech is the first son of God. We have the sons of God then continuing to reject secure community. Remember, as we looked at all the possibilities of sons of God, most likely it's the rulers of the different areas. So the rulers continue to reject secure community. Do you remember how? By the rite of first night. Remember that? They took the brides that were to be married, and they had the right of conjugation with them before their husbands-to-be. And so, obviously, they're rejecting secure community, and they're obscuring God's presence. Completely opaque to being able to see God's presence, and it affects the entire world, and so much so that it fills the world with violence. Remember that space that was supposed to be filled with order? It's now filled with violence, and God has to mitigate it somehow. And so he brings the flood. And he brings the flood, he wipes that out. Let's start again. We have a new family, and then we have the situation with Ham. And Ham, being one of eight that survives, he continues the pattern from before the flood. He just takes off right where the sons of God left off. And he also rejects secure community. Why? Because he decides that it would be a great idea to go have children with his mother. And so we have that looking on his father's nakedness. And he discounts God's presence. Yes, God has saved me, but so what? Big deal. Why do I have to go under his order? And it affects the new world. And lastly, we have Babel. We have all the people of the earth. Remember, it happens in one area to represent all of the earth. Babel rejects the presence of God. And what they do, they don't ignore God's presence, they don't obscure God's presence, they don't discount God's presence, they actually recreate God's presence in their own image. Remember, they build their own Eden, their own center of order. They build this ziggurat so that God can come down. But the God that they're talking about is a God that they've made up. A God who's just like them, who needs to eat and sleep. Remember, at the top of the ziggurat, we have a bed and food. He needs to come and get worship so that he can give. He's transactional. He looks just like them. Therefore, they can manipulate him. And so, it affects all of humanity as they recreate God's presence in their own image. And that's where we ended Genesis 1 through 11. So that's kind of our, that's where we've been. Where are we going? Well, God's story continues. He's going to reveal his work along with his presence. So let's look at the big picture of where we're going, and then we'll kind of narrow it down just a bit. God is still working. In order for us to pay attention to God's work, we must know that he is working. It is dangerous for us to interpret the 6 days of creation as the end of his work. If I hear this one more time, and God, that was the end of his work, about Sabbath, that his rest was disengagement, I want to go to every person I've ever heard that from and say, do you know that you're bringing people into a false reality when you say that? That's dangerous for us to say. Because what it does then, it makes us assume that God did everything, put it in motion, sent it off and said, okay, you're on your own now. Which is really how most people in the world think about God. He's done it, and now it's on our own. We're responsible for everything. It makes us think also that Sabbath, or rest, is disengagement. That God completely disengaged. But what is rest? What is Sabbath? What is our definition?
It's a space where God rules and reigns. Without obstacle.
Right. It's where God is at home, right? He rules and reigns without obstacle. That's Sabbath. That's rest. Rest is not disengagement. Rest is not, oh, I don't have to deal with anything now. No, rest is like, oh, now I can actually do what I'm meant to be doing. And so it's dangerous for us to interpret the 6 days of creation as the end of his work. It's just as dangerous for us to interpret the confession of belief in Jesus as the end of his work. I've said the prayer and so I'm good. And I know many people who said that as well. So if we're following his continued story, we need to ask, if God's work of revealing himself to the world was rejected, what is his continued work? Does he give up on drawing humanity to himself? Does he try a new approach as if his initial work was a failure? One thing he will not do is speak to the world for further revelation. Because the world isn't listening. From Noah's time to Babel, when the world replaced God's presence with their own God made in their own image, they're only listening to themselves. And if they're only listening to themselves, how is God going to continue to reveal himself? He will continue. As planned, no change in plans, he will go deeper and more intimate in his revelation of him by establishing a family. A family who is in covenant relationship, drawing one family to himself, right? Making them pay attention, doing something that says, you are the sparkle of my eye. In fact, it says that, right? Mm-hmm. You are the apple of my eye, and I am going to do something for your benefit. I'm going to continue to do that until you pay attention to me, draw near to me, attach to me, listen to me, so that if humanity, if the world is only listening to themselves, oh, God then will talk through humanity, through his family. That's why he needs a covenant family. That's why Genesis 12 and on. And he will do so in order to reverse humanity's rejection of his presence. Because all creation depends on humanity taking up their relational role of ruling and relating. So the reversal then is going to begin backwards. It's going to start with their disordered thinking about God as made in the image of man. Because only when we know who God is and what he does can we know who we are and what we are to do. And so that's what he's going to do with his family. He's going to draw them near. He's going to bring them into attachment. He's going to mold their character so that they can speak. Because that's who humanity's listening to. So, what work is he doing? A good work for sure. The good work is the work of restoration. We often tend to think of our salvation, the salvation of our souls, as the extent of God's work. But salvation is not finished when we come to faith. That's why Paul says in Philippians, I'm confident of this, that he who began a good work in you will finish it. It's not finished. His work is not finished. The gift of faith is just the beginning of the good work in you. Because the work is the restoration of all things. And humanity's restoration has to happen for the rest of creation's restoration to happen.
It's like salvation is the DTR in the relationship. Define the relationship.
Yes, exactly. Yes, exactly. It is. It's just the beginning. It's the wedding, right? And how many of you know of young girls who looked forward forever about the wedding? They had pictures, they had dresses, they had all this, right? And never gave a thought to what happens after. The wedding is a blip. It's great, it can be beautiful, but that's actually not what you're going for. So God is going to continue his work by drawing together a family where he will continually show up for this family, where he will continue work on their behalf and attract their attention. And that attention will be recognized as a place of belonging so that they form attachment, and those attachments form new character in them, different from the ones they inherited from the world, which means the focus of his work is going to be the transformation of character in one family. And that family will be tasked to share themselves, which will reveal God's presence and work. So, we are given then the knowledge of God's good work. The knowledge will come through personal and intimate stories of God's relationship with his family. Think about it. Big general stories, like the people in Africa are starving or the minorities of this country are suffering oppression, they touch our emotions on the surface. But when we're given a personal, intimate story of a young boy roaming the plains of Africa because his parents have both died, and a military man comes, takes him into his home, dresses him, feeds him, raises him up, and brainwashes him to become a child soldier. Oh, that, right? That touches us much deeper. That emotional level is much deeper. It's not just information anymore. It's not just, oh, that poor boy. Now it's like, and I tell that story because that was the beginning of the Lost Boys era, right? And my daughter was greatly affected by that. And she had showings of the movie all the time and gatherings of people, and we've got to do something about this. I mean, that affects us. That's what we're getting in Genesis 12 through 50, are these intimate stories of God's family. So that when we know what the work of God is, it helps us to submit to what is necessary. It's like if you go to a dentist. I have a woman dentist now. She tells you that you have severe decay in your teeth. She's going to need to take out that pocket of decay and make a new element, precious metal, to fill in that cavity that she's going to take out, right? So that the work of God in us, in his family, is the reestablishing of order, of what is good. Just like the dentist is going to put in something that is going to be ordered, that works well. We are God's workmanship, his masterpiece, his poeme. And it starts with right thinking about who he is. It replaces the disordered thinking about who he is. He's not made in my image. He's not like me. He wants to make me like him. So knowing the work of God, knowing what it is, helps us submit to what is necessary. But knowing the purpose of the work helps us to realize our worth. Like a dentist. I want to do this for you. I want to take out the decay, fill it with something good, so you'll be able to eat without pain and further loss of teeth. The purpose of God, we are God's workmanship, created in Christ for good works, for putting in order into the world. It's bigger than an individual rescue from harm. No, he's doing that so that we actually can do what we're meant to do. Just like the dentist filling in our tooth, make sure that the teeth are able to do what they're supposed to do. So the purpose of God's work is to make us into people who can cooperatively work with him to reestablish order in the world. So knowing what the work is, knowing the purpose of the work, knowing the goal of the work, the telos of the work, helps us to persevere. What's the goal? The dentist's goal is so you can continue to have life sustained. If I don't do this, not only will you lose that tooth, but that decay will keep going, and you'll lose another tooth and another tooth, and pretty soon you won't have any teeth, and you won't be able to eat, and you won't be able to live. That's the telos. This is the goal. I'm making sure that you can live. The telos of God is Sabbath, where God can rule and relate without obstacle, with humanity able to do the same, where we can dwell together at rest, where we can occupy reality, be at home with who we are. That is reality, life. That's where we're going. That's what God has intended for us. So to know the work of God, to know the purpose of the work of God, and to know the goal of the work of God is all very important, and we're going to learn these things as we look at the patriarchs. One last thing to know about the work of God is the means by which he works, because that will help us focus on him rather than us. We pay attention to what he's doing so we can partner with him, rather than what we are striving to do and accomplish to show him that we're worthy. The dentist says, I'm going to use Novocaine, I'm going to use a drill, I'm going to use this metal that is going to be individually molded to your cavity. I'm going to, over time, have you chew on it and mold it to where it fits you perfectly. And I'm going to use my training and my skill and my practice so that I can assure a best outcome. God's means of restoring us is the revelation of himself in covenant relationship. Because in relationship, in covenant relationship, he provokes emotion, he gets our attention, he draws us to attachment, and in attachment, he molds our character, enabling us to think with him, partner with him, and be able to go out and give him. So knowing what his work is, the purpose of his work, the goal of his work, and the means by which he works will help us to be able to come under his work voluntarily. So as we get to Genesis 12 through 36, we see that God reveals his work to his family. Genesis 12 through 36, what he's going to do is mold the patriarchs. He's going to mold them within relationship in order to transform character. And he's going to do that in a two-step process. He's going to expose their barrenness and thus allows the Spirit to do the hovering, the devouring work, right? He's going to have the Spirit come over them and recognize, oh, what you filled your life with, that's all decay. That's all stuff that isn't going to sustain you. We must drill out that decay. And then he's going to fill that space that he makes in all of the patriarchs. And he's going to fill that space with his own character that enables them to become like him and to be able to give him out. That's Genesis 12 through 36. Genesis 37 through 50 is going to be all about strengthening the family individuals, putting them under pressure, because just like a filling, when the dentist puts a filling in your mouth, what's the next step that she does? She does one other thing, most dentists do. She puts a UV light on it to harden it faster. Because if she doesn't harden it, it could get cracks in it quickly, right? She hardens it to instill tensile strength, to make it flexible without breakage. God strengthens us by putting us under pressure, allowing his family to be in the world, to give God's blessings to the world without being broken by the world, assimilated into the world. So, patriarchs is about molding the character into them. Joseph is going to be about strengthening God's character. Also, that these image bearers that he's taken out of the families, right? He separated them at Babel. He's going to take the image bearers and he's going to make them blessing bearers. So, what about us then? God's story revealed in us. We're the family of God, and we're the family of God in the world. So we need to think, what is the world today? Well, from Adam and Eve's time onward, the world tells us that reality is that life is war. We have to fight for ourselves. We have to stand up for ourselves. We have to get what we want by taking it. We must go for it. All sorts of things, right? This is what the world tells us. It says we're going to have to separate from certain others to be able to get what we want, to be able to determine who we are. We're going to have to separate from ourselves so that we elevate ourselves. We're going to have to participate in some sort of us and them paradigm. That's what the world tells us. I read this really insightful journalist. His name is Ben Sixsmith, and he writes for The Spectator. Listen to what he says. I'm not religious, so it's not my place to dictate to Christians what they should and should not believe. Still, if someone has a faith worth following, I feel that their beliefs should make me feel uncomfortable for not doing so. If they share 90% of my lifestyle and my values, then there is nothing especially inspiring about them. Instead of making me want to become more like them, it looks very much as if they want to become more like me. The church today, where are we? We are supposed to be where the world can see God's work and presence and be drawn to him. We must remember that God always deals with his family first. They're the only ones listening. Humanity in the world is not listening to God, which means anytime there's upheaval in the world, God is not talking to the world. Who's God talking to? Us. Absolutely us. He's tapping us, the church, on the shoulder. What's he saying? You've gone off track, church. You have embraced false realities in one of two ways. You've either emphasized behavior, results, over character, or you've adapted world ideas of right order instead of God's order. And the problem is both of those concentrate on doing rather than receiving. The emphasis of Genesis 12 through 50 is on God's family receiving his work of molding and strengthening his character into them. So that we can give ourselves, which calls attention to God's presence and work. Isn't that what Matthew says? Matthew says something like, let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify God who's in heaven. We are called to be standing in the gap, as it were, of the lack of knowledge of who God is and therefore who humanity is. We're the ones who stand in the gap. The church, in the midst of wars, should look like the Red Cross. And I didn't look, but I wonder, how did the Red Cross get its name?
Oh. Clara Barton. I don't
know. But Red Cross? What did the Red Cross do? They come in the midst of war to feed, to bind up, and to clean up. They don't come to enter the war. But it's not a passive role. It's an intermediary role. It offers an alternative reality to what the war says is reality. The only true reality is what they're offering. Where worth is not dependent on being on the right side, nor on winning the war, but dependent on the God whose very life is open invitation to belonging. So the church must be receivers first. So now, I want you to get out what you have underneath there, underneath your seats. We need to be open to participating in the process. So what I want you to do, you have some dough there. I want you to, I've given you gloves that you can use. I want you to mold, to shape a little doll of yourself. So I want you to do this quickly. This is just a, just give it a head, two arms, and two legs. That's all I need you to do. So do that quickly.
Mm-hmm. It's cooking, isn't it? Don't eat it. How many carbs are in here? I'm kidding.
January people, relax.
So, at home, if you're watching this, I would encourage you to do this. It's always good to have something tactile to kind of remember what's going on. All of us have actually shaped our own lives. Right? We've made ourselves who we want it to be, who we think we are. But there you go. But what is God doing in Genesis? He's saying exactly what Paul says in Romans. Present your bodies what? As a living sacrifice. So give me your living sacrifices. Can you see that? This feels like a real baby. And that process, this process of molding that God is actually, bring that up. Submission to molding is always going to require an exposure that what you've created independently is barrenness. Because what good is this to anybody? You can't eat it because it's raw. Raw eggs are in there. You want to eat that? It could make you sick. What you shape is not good for anyone. Your barrenness isn't good. But when you present your body as a living sacrifice, you will say to God, mold me. Go ahead and do the work that you want me to do. And yes, that does mean your beautifully worked on form will be, I'm going to show you here, squished. Oh, and squeezed. Oh, and pushed into something completely unrecognizable. And in fact, when I keep on pushing these forms into this, you can't even tell, right? What you had created. And sometimes I'm going to have to take out part of what you've created. Take it off and keep it there and I'm going to keep pressing in until it is where I want it. Taking off, pressing in. That molding is not going to be comfortable. But the new form is a beautiful design. And that new form is much prettier than what is as much as well as you did with your little forms. This is more beautiful. And yet it's still not ready, right? But the form, the fact that you presented your bodies as sacrifice, you presented your lives, is going to be a beautiful posture of receiving. I want to receive the molding that God wants to do for me. It's very akin to what Mary did in Luke 1. Mary first says, when the angel says to her, you're going to have a child, she says, how can this be? I am a virgin. I am barren. I have this space. How in the world does the exposure of my barrenness become a part of restoration? Oh, God says, because the Spirit's coming and I'm going to fill it. He says the Holy Spirit will come upon you and the power of the Most High will hover, overshadow you, and fill you. And what's Mary's response? Be it done to me. And anyone who's been in Genesis 1 through 11 better recognize something. What did God keep on saying? Eve, what have you done? Cain, what have you done? To the people who weren't listening in Noah's days, what have you done? Remember the word is asah. What order have you created? What new order? What disorder have you created? But Mary, he doesn't say that to Mary, because Mary says, let it be done to me. Create in me a clean heart. Fill the space within me. That's what Genesis 12 through 50 is all about. So that we receive the molding, but also, as beautiful as this molding is that I did here in the mold, it's beautiful. It's still not ready. It's still not good for anybody. What am I going to need to do with that? I'm going to need to bake it. I'm going to need to put it on the cookie sheet and bake it. And then, maybe then, it'll be useful to somebody. Somebody can eat it. Or maybe we wait and put them all together. And maybe we can eat a lot of people. And so, receiving the strength is to be put us under pressure, under heat, where we don't clamor for our rights or privileges, but we pay attention to what God is working in me. To solidify molding so we can withstand the pressures of the world calling to us to attach to them. So that we're able to be givers. So that the life of Jesus may be manifested in our body. Remember, Corinthians says, we have this treasure in jars of clay. So that the surpassing power of God, the surpassing power is understood to be from God and not from us. Jars of clay need to be shaped by someone over time. Lumps of clay cannot shape themselves. A master sculptor, one who is trustworthy and attentive, is necessary if you want a final product to be beautiful and useful. How many of you have ever tried to make something? It's tough. It looks so easy, and you think, oh, all you're doing is sitting there and the wheel's going. No, it's really tough. Very tough to make something good. After a master sculptor sculpts it, the jars of clay need to be strengthened into place by fire so they can work well, so they can do good works. Jars of clay are then given and assigned a function to hold water, so they need a right shape without holes. Actually, the function comes first, so that they're able to pour out water over and over and over again, so they're flexible to perform the task. In order to refresh and quench the thirst of others, which is exactly what John 7 says about the Holy Spirit. You will be given the Holy Spirit and living water that will pour out of you. It doesn't say you'll be given the water, the living waters. It says that will pour out of you for others so that we will become blessing bearers. We are, in fact, the letters of revelation of who God is. We are who the world can listen to. They are not listening to God. They're going to listen to us if we have something else to give them. Remember what Ben Sixsmith said. We are the letters of Epiphany. So we just came through the season of Epiphany. Short season, but remember Epiphany means revelation, where God reveals himself to the world. We celebrate Epiphany because it's when the Magi first saw the baby Jesus. And the Magi represent the world. Right? They're Gentiles. They're not God's family. They're Gentiles. And so we then become epiphanies, revelation of who God is. So if you are particularly in the Orthodox Church, during Epiphany, some Christians will mark letters on their door frame. The letters are C, M, and B with the sign of the cross. Originally, that was meant to designate the names of the Magi, who were who represented the world, Caspar, Melchior, and Balthazar. But it came to mean a Latin prayer, the Latin prayer, Christus Mansionem Benedicat, may Christ bless this house. So if we really are desiring the blessing of Christ, what we're asking for is for his work of molding us, of giving us his character, so that we're molded and strengthened, that we might be blessing bearers. So this semester, instead of artwork, we're going to use letters. I love calligraphy. This is what I could find for letters. We're going to start with, that's why there's a big C on your workbook, yep. Right? So that we have this idea that we are letters of revelation. We are epiphanies. We're who the world reads if they're going to read about reality. We are the ones to be able to reveal God's presence and God's work. We are the Red Cross who come and mediate and feed the world. And in fact, that's exactly what we're going to see in Genesis, the rest of Genesis. And so we'll end every class with a blessing from Hebrews 13. May the God of peace equip you to do every good work according to his will, working in us that which is pleasing in his sight, through Jesus Christ, to whom be the glory forever and ever. Amen. Hebrews 13.
I didn't hear it. I'm sorry, I didn't hear it.
Hebrews 13:21.